2 weeks ago, I covered 1 Kings chapter 17. Today, I intend to cover that again, but also in conjunction with 2 Kings chapter 4. I mentioned it, the chapter 17 of 1 Kings was full and a bit complex. I could not cover it in a single session, which I didn't. So I'm going to cover it yet again, expound a little deeper in certain areas, and tie it to 2 Kings 4. And hopefully by the end of my little spiel today, I'll be able to explain to you why I'm tying it together. And then there will be a sort of like a part 3 next time, which is 1 Kings chapter 18. But that, because chapter 18 and 17 are jumbled together into a single story. Almighty God, our Father in heaven, thank you for your wisdom and your kindness upon each of us. Please bless this day and bless this, the understandings and the conversations and discussions, that your will be known, that we follow what is good and right, what is fair, what is just, and we understand more of why you do what you do. As the psalmist says, we are not like a horse that is uncomprehending and pulls and goes wherever its rider tells it. Help us, Father, to be comprehending. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen. So I intend to reread 1 Kings chapter 17 and then 2 Kings chapter 4, not the whole chapter 4, but the most of it, with the goal or the intention of for most of you to see or recognize a number of similarities. Now, don't get me wrong, I intend to, in the future, cover 2 Kings chapter 4 yet again when I get to that part in their sequential stories. Because there's a lot of it in that chapter I will not be talking about today, but I have to talk about parts of it. So let's reread 1 Kings chapter 17 before we go to 2 Kings chapter 4. Elisha the Tishbite, a resident of Gilead, said to Ahab, "As the Lord God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, I swear there will be no dew nor rain these years except by my word." The word of the Lord came to him, saying, "Go from here and turn eastward. You shall hide in the Cherith brook, which faces the Jordan. It shall be that you will drink from the brook that I have commanded ravens to supply you with food there." So he went and acted according to the word of the Lord. He went and settled in the Cherith brook, which faces the Jordan. The ravens would bring him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he would drink from the brook. It happened at the end of a year, the brook dried up, for there was no rain in the land. The word of the Lord then came and said, "Arise, go to Zarephath of the territory of Sidon, and settle there. Behold, I have commanded a widow to sustain you there." So he arose and went to Zarephath and arrived at the entrance to the city. Behold, a widow was gathering wood there. He called to her and said, "Fetch me some water in a vessel that I may drink." She went to get it, and he called to her, saying, "Fetch me also a piece of bread in your hand." She said, "As the Lord your God lives, I swear I have not so much as a cookie, but only a handful of flour in a jug, and a bit of oil in a cruse. Behold, I am gathering 2 pieces of wood. Then I will go and prepare it for myself and my son. We will eat it, and then we will die." Elijah said to her, "Fear not. Go, do as you have said, but first prepare a small cake from it for me, and bring it out to me, and prepare also for yourself and your son. Afterward, for thus says the Lord God of Israel, the jug of flour shall not run out, the flask of oil shall not lack, until the day the Lord provides rain upon the face of the earth." She went and did according to the word of Elijah, and she ate, and she and he and her household for a year. The jug of flour did not run out, and the cruse of oil did not lack, in accordance with the word of the Lord, which he had spoken through Elijah. Now it happened after these events, the son of the woman, the landlady, became ill. His illness became very serious until there was no breath left in him. She said to Elijah, "What is there between me and you, O man of God, that you have come to me to call attention to my sins and cause my son to die?" He said to her, "Give me your son." He took him from her bosom and brought him to the upper story where he was dwelling and laid him on his own bed. He called out to the Lord and said, "Lord God, my God, have you brought harm even upon the widow with whom I dwell to cause her son to die?" He stretched himself out over the boy 3 times. He called out to the Lord and said, "O Lord, my God, please let this boy's soul come back within him." The Lord hearkened to the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the boy came back within him, and he came to life. Elijah took the boy and brought him down from the upper story of the house and delivered him to his mother. Elijah said, "See, your son is alive." The woman said to Elijah, "Now I know through this that you are a man of God, and the word of the Lord is in your mouth." It's true. Now let's jump to 2 Kings chapter 4, where it's where the companion or sister story to this chapter exists. One woman from among the wives of the prophet's disciples cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, has died, and you know that your servant feared the Lord. But now the creditor has come to take my two sons to be his slaves." Elisha said to her, "What can I do for you? Tell me, what have you in the house?" She said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house except for a jar of oil." He said, "Go, borrow vessels for yourself from outside, from all your neighbors. Empty vessels, do not be sparing. Then go in and shut the door behind you and behind your sons. Pour oil into all these vessels and carry away the full ones." She went from him and shut the door behind her and behind her children. They brought vessels to her and she poured. When all the containers were full, she said to her sons, "Bring me another vessel." He said to her, "There is not another vessel." And the oil stopped. She came and told the man of God and said, "Go." And he said, "Go, sell the oil, pay your creditor, and you and your sons will live on the remainder." It happened one day, Elisha traveled to Shunem. There was a prominent woman there, and she importuned him to eat a meal. So it was, whenever he passed by, he would turn in there to eat a meal. She once said to her husband, "Behold, I now know that he is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Let us now make a small walled attic and place there for him a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp, so that whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there." It happened one day that he arrived there, and he turned into the attic and lay down. He said to Gehazi, his attendant, "Summon the Shunammite woman." He summoned her, and she stood before him. Then he said to Gehazi, "Please, say to her, 'Behold, you have undertaken all this exertion on our behalf. What favor can be done for you? Can something be said on your behalf to the king or the army commander?'" She replied, "I dwell among my people." So he said to Gehazi, "What can be done for her?" Gehazi said, "Actually, she has no child, and her husband is old." He said, "Summon her." So he summoned her, and she stood in the doorway. Elisha said, "At this season, next year, you will be embracing a son." She said, "No, do not, my master, O man of God, do not disappoint your maidservant." The woman conceived and bore a son at that season, the next year, as Elisha had told her. The boy grew up. It happened one day, he went out to his father to the reapers in the field. He said to his father, "My head, my head!" His father said to an attendant, "Carry him to his mother." He carried him and brought him to his mother. He sat in her lap until noon, and then he died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door behind him and left. She then called her husband and said, "Please, send me one of the attendants and one of the donkeys, so that I may hurry to the man of God and return." He said, "Why are you going to him today? It is not a new moon, nor a Sabbath." She replied, "It is well." She saddled the donkey and said to her attendant, "Lead and go, and do not impede me from riding unless I tell you." She set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. When the man of God saw her from afar, he said to Gehazi's attendant, "Behold, it is that Shunammite woman. Now, please, run toward her and say to her, 'Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the boy?'" She replied to Gehazi, "It is well." She came before the man of God on the mountain and grasped his legs. Gehazi approached to push her away, but the man of God said, "Leave her, for her soul is bitter within her, and the Lord has hidden it from me and not told me." She said, "Did I request a son of my master? Did I not say, 'Do not mislead me?'" He said to Gehazi, "Gird your loins, take my staff in your hand and go. If you meet a man, do not greet him. If a man greets you, do not respond to him. Place my staff on the lad's head." The lad's mother said, "I swear as the Lord lives, and I swear as you live, I will not leave you." So he arose and went after her. Gehazi went ahead of them and placed the staff on the lad's face, but there was no sound and nothing was heard. He returned toward Elisha and told him, saying, "The lad has not awakened." Elisha came to the house, and behold, the lad was dead, laid out on his bed. He entered and shut the door behind them both and prayed to the Lord. He went up and laid upon the boy, placing his mouth upon his mouth, his eyes upon his eyes, and his palms upon his palms. He stretched himself out over him and warmed the flesh of the boy. He withdrew and walked through the house, once this way and once that way. Then he went up and stretched himself over him. And the lad sneezed 7 times, and the lad opened his eyes. Elisha called Gehazi and said, "Summon the Shunammite woman." He summoned her, and she came to him and said, "Pick up your son." She came and fell at his feet. She bowed down to the ground, and she picked up her son and left. So that was 2 Kings chapter 4, from verse 4 through 37, contrasted to 1 Kings chapter 17. Now, hopefully, after reading both these chapters, now granted, I've read these chapters many, many, many times, so I have looked at extensively on the details. Hopefully you saw a few similarities. It's not the same account. They're two different things. They are very, very similar. Why? We're going to discuss that today. Why? I've discussed this in the past many times. Your Bibles use, and God used many times, a thematic and thematic structure, thematic ties. So when you read a story in one spot, and it sounds like a story in another place, it's supposed to. God did it on purpose, with one objective. And what is the objective? Read them both. Tie them together. Because something is hidden in these stories that you're supposed to learn and supposed to know. I listed up here a number of the similarities, not all of them, but a good percentage of them, of the similarities between these stories on my little chart up here. We're going to discuss some details as to why this is done, because Messiah explained it to us in the book of Luke. In the first Kings chapter 17, of course, we already discussed this last time, this Gentile widow, right? She's a widow, she has no certain future. Well, in 2 Kings chapter 4, it's a prophet's widow. Two different type of women, but both in the same circumstance. Both have children, no husband left. One, of course, is from the people of Israel. She is within the territory of Israel. The other one is from Sidon. I do not recall, or doesn't specify, where the widow happened to be from in Elisha's story. The future of the one in 1 Kings from Elijah is the future is to be death. They're going to, both the widow and the child are going to starve to death. And of course, there's no means, they have no method of getting out of this problem. They have no means for salvation for themselves. They had a little bit of flour and oil, and the Lord said that their flour and oil would not run out Elijah said, the flour and oil will not run out until he sends rain. The Lord sends rain. And it lasted for about a year. In the prophet's story, the future of the children is not death, but is slavery. Now, they have no means for salvation, they have a little bit of oil, and they did not run out till the vessels were full, though the oil didn't run out, and of course they paid the debt and gave the means for them to live. When you see parallel stories like this, there's details that God's trying to tell you about. When you have chunks, by the way, this brief section up here was only discussion of the widow's prophet's story, not Shunammite. We'll discuss Shunammite woman's story later, but this is the first section of just the oil and just the flower details. When you have duplicate stories like this, God's making equivalents. So the Gentile woman is approximately equivalent to the prophet's widow, the Gentile widow. And that means the future of the widow and the child is death, is approximately equivalent to slavery to the children in the other story. What does it tell you about death? Well, death is slavery. And slavery is death. That's what God's telling us. There's no means of salvation for either one of them. It means that they don't have the ability to get them out of this problem. This is their permanent fixed future. They have little oil, little flour. We won't discuss all the symbols between oil and flour. We discussed this a little bit previously. But it does usually is associated with sight as far as oil is concerned, meaning understanding or comprehending God's will. Now it also points out in the first story of 1 Kings chapter 17 that the flour and oil will not run out till the Lord sends rain. The oil did not run out till the vessels were full. So the Lord sending rain and full vessels are equivalent. they're filled up. If my cup is overflowing, my cup is full, that's the principle behind it that God pulls out. It lasted for about a year in this case for the Gentile widow. In this case, and for the Israelite widow, the prophet's widow, it paid her debt and of course gave her means to survive on itself. So the lasting or the duration of the miracle, the duration of the purpose of it, was to last until this trial was completed or over. We have similar stories. Not duplicates, but very, very similar. We'll discuss the Shunat one in a minute. Now, the Messiah said this one regarding Elijah and the woman of Sidon is like him. He said, I am equal to this story. But this story in Elijah is equal to this story in Elisha. So, if Messiah equals Elijah, and Elijah equals Elisha, Messiah equals Elisha. Basic math. So God, Messiah is tying himself to this story in Elijah in book of Luke chapter 4. Which is already tied to this one. So everybody who heard or hears Messiah say he is tied to Elijah's story, that is him, or he's part of that story that's about him, also has to know or realizes or make the connection that it's also that this one, in Elisha's story, is also about him. They're the same stories, they're about the same man. We'll draw that up and discuss it shortly, but not right now. So this is the first part of their stories as to why they're so similar. There's more to it than that. Now, continuing on my little breakdown. Now, this is not exhaustive, but it is fairly descriptive. In the second half of the story, the same woman in Elijah's story, of course, is now his landlady. And the Shunammite woman in Elisha's story sort of is. He's not really paying rent, it's more of just he stays there because of her kindness. These women are different. These are not the same kind of woman. The Gentile widow and the prophet's widow, neither one of those two women are like the Shunammite woman. But yet at the same time, they are all similar. They're different groups or classifications of people we're talking about here. They all go through the same existence. They all require the same solution. But they are quite different in their backgrounds and history and knowledge and understanding and belief of God. In Elijah's story, for the second half of it, the one, of course, was assigned or told, not told, Elijah was told by God that the woman has been selected to provide food for him and, of course, for shelter. In Elisha's second part of his story, the Shunammite woman, she voluntarily or actually implores or begs him to come in to eat with her. So instead of him being told by God that she's designed to assist him, she is putting herself upon him to give him food. Different in type of people, different in the way in which they do things, but they still accomplish the same effect, provide food and provide food. The Elijah's story, the widow, provided a bed in her upper story. Well, in the Shunammite woman's story, she provided a bed or roof also in the upper story, in this case an attic, designed for both men. Again, more similarities. The death of the son for Elijah's story, the widow, the Gentile widow, ended the promise that Elijah had given to her that she and her son would live with the whole food details. That it wouldn't run out, nothing to worry about, just provide for me. That implied that she and her son would not starve to death. That was the objective. Well, in this story, the death of that son, also for the Shunammite woman, ended the promise that she was promised a son. Because when you're promised a son, one can say, oh, well, he didn't promise he would live to be an old man. That's unfair. When you're promised a son, you naturally assume, when you're promised a child, the child will at least live to a certain reasonable age. May not forever, but at least to a reasonable age. All that is entailed inside the story. Imagine for a moment that Abraham and Sarah knew full well their son was going to be killed at the age of, well, I don't know, whatever, 10. Well, wait a minute. Was that a fair promise from God then? No, it wouldn't be. It didn't live long. Exactly. To continue on, generations didn't happen. The continue on life didn't exist. They realized for a while that Isaac would not have lived forever, but eventually to live long enough to actually have more children of his own. So that promise would have ended. And this Ishmaelite woman's promise also ended. She said, this wasn't fair. You broke the rules. You broke the details of what a son means. So that was broken. So as far as they're concerned, the death of the son ended the promises that both women had received. Now, Elijah then takes the boy up to his bed and conceals him from his mom. She's not in the bed. She's left behind. He separates her out, takes him away from her, separates the two of them. Now, the Shunammite woman sort of did it herself. She goes up to the bed, again, up to the same, not same man, but the symbolically same man, up to their own individual beds in their respective rooms. She sets the boy up, closes the door, doesn't tell anybody he's dead. She conceals it, literally, from her own husband, from the boy's dad. And conceals it also literally from Gehazi. She says, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha who goes and asks, is all well? She says, all's well. Nothing's wrong. We're all good. Which wasn't true. The boy was already dead. So she is concealing him literally while Elijah did it figuratively, not with words, but actually just physically did it. So she's concealed. They're both concealed. The dead bodies are concealed. Now Elijah and Elisha both were unaware of what God's plan was. They didn't know what the objective of why was God doing this. God did not explain them ahead of time what he was doing or why he was doing it. Each man made 3 attempts to revive the boy. Now, you look over there and look at Elisha's story, it shows him only laid on the boy twice. Well, but Gehazi had already made an attempt early with the staff. So the full 3 attempts were made for the boy for Elisha's story, the Shunammite woman's boy. And there were, of course, 3 attempts made from Elijah to, again, revive the boy. They both used a particular technique of laying their bodies upon the child. I would argue these stories are similar. They sound a lot alike to me. Maybe you disagree, but I think they do. Now, when we have stories that are similar, as I already mentioned earlier, God's making an equivalent statement. These stories are equal to each other. When you say something is equal to something else, that means the details are equal too, not just the overall concept. As I had mentioned earlier, in the Gentile woman's story, when I had said that their future was death of starvation, while in the future of the prophet woman's children, their future was slavery, that's making an equivalent statement that slavery is equivalent to death. Well, that was obvious in that story, because they're being compared to one another. Well, in this story, with the death of the sons, they're also being equivalent to one another. So that means the differences are also equivalent. What's the main difference? Now, obviously there are a lot of differences. I'm talking, what's the main difference from these stories? They're both unaware of the plan, so that's just a similarity of the prophets themselves. They're not aware of the plan. Messiah says he is this story here, in Elijah's story section. But this story of Elijah is continued on and extends all the way through all of chapter 17 and chapter 18. So if Messiah says, I'm here, he's saying, I am all of here. It's all me. And all of me, meaning all these stories, are all tied to Elisha's story. That means Messiah is all over here as well, in Elisha, back in 2 Kings. Oh, yeah, sorry, you had a question.
You opened up and you said that the Messiah is connected to...
He ties himself to the story.
But to only to one of them.
He ties him to both.
Wait.
Go ahead.
Because he said, spirit of Elijah. Not Elijah. Elijah, but Elijah. Right?
Yeah, right.
And I find, okay, that's fascinating. And here we have, in a sense, the first resurrection.
There is.
And the second one comes through what you may call as a second resurrection.
There is. And that has to do with who the women are.
Yeah.
It's the women that's the details. So we're going to talk about
that. I understand that
next.
One, but I just find that very fascinating.
Right. So he's right. In the, at the moment in time which Messiah said that statement, he was literally talking about only this section of the story. Just the part where Elijah has to leave and flee his own country. Because his own, this is in chapter 4, book of Luke. He says, I have to leave because I'm rejected, a prophet's rejected his own country. At the moment he says that, he's only here. But as he continues on his life, he fulfills, Messiah does, the rest of Messiah's, however, his prophecy, however long it lasted, his service. He fulfills all the rest of it too. So although he, at the moment in time, says, I'm this, we, after reading his whole story, we know he fulfills all of this with the whole death, the resurrection, the promise, all those details. So that's what I'm talking about, is that I know that Messiah specifically said this, but he's actually, when he completed his ministry, he did all of it. So he was all of it.
There is,
which we'll discuss that in a little detail, but note, almost everything that's Enoch is focused or pointing our eyes toward him in some way or another. So that's the objective. So any story you see, if it's an interesting story, some stories are not so interesting. I get that. But some of them are. You know, genealogies can be, but sometimes they're not so interesting. Some of them are focused enough, but they're all focused predominantly to him. Either something he did do or is going to do. So, have you written down your notes? Okay. I'm going to erase this now. These two stories I mentioned earlier, were already connected to each other before Messiah was born. All the people who Messiah was talking to knew the story of Elijah. And they all knew the story of Elisha. So those people who Messiah was addressing already knew these stories are equivalent. And Messiah says, I'm one of the men at this moment in time. And of course, as he goes with life, he fulfills that man completely. That everybody then knows, okay, Messiah isn't just one of these stories, he is both stories. And the purpose of why I want to talk to you today is, why? What is it about both stories that Messiah wanted to tie himself to? What detail or details was he trying to say? Or get people to focus their eyes to? Was it just to recognize him? Well, sure, I'm sure that's a large portion of it. But these stories give us a specific detail. Both boys die. They both die and they both are resurrected. So we know that part's the same, which as Messiah did. But the key differences between these stories are the women. The prophet's widow, the Gentile widow, and the Shunammite woman. Those women have completely different backgrounds. They're virtually unrelated to each other. I say virtually because they obviously are, there are some relations here or there, but not significant ones. So Messiah is these stories. These stories are tied together very heavily. We won't go into all that detail of all the ties because there's more than what I have written up here. I'm going to erase some of this stuff and draw another diagram if you don't mind. Gentile widow. Details about her. Certain things we already know. First of all, does not know God. Meaning, she does eventually, in part, but not the same detail as an Israelite woman is supposed to know God, or an Israelite man that knows God. It didn't trust him. He was essentially a foreign God to her. She's from Sidon. She's separate. She's different from him. Does not know God. The prophet's widow does know God. Does know God, but it's, she is not claimed to know God, meaning of herself. She knows God in that her husband was a prophet. So she is the prophet's widow. Her connection and details to God are through her husband. Not necessarily her. Not that she didn't know God. Don't get me wrong, I'm not slandering her. I'm just specifying that the Bible explicitly identifies her connection to God is through her husband. And of course, how Elisha knew or knows her husband. The Shunammite woman is herself. Distinctly knows God. So the prophet's widow knows God through husband. The Shunammite woman, I'll put Shunim because I always misspelled Shunammite. She herself is just plain righteous. She knows God personally. She is personally, intimately related to God. Why do I say that? Well, look at what she did in her life. She's a Shunammite woman. She identified this individual as being a man of God. She, by her own accord, implored him to come and eat food with her. She implored her husband to build a room for him. She did all her efforts to make this man comfortable. On top of that, which I love this lady for it, when Elisha asks her, what can I do? Speak to the king, to the commander, whatever. She says one statement, which is perfect. I dwell among my own people. What does that mean? What does it mean to dwell among your own people? She doesn't need or care what the king or what the army does or wants. The two women we read today, the Hebrew midwives, they would be classified as they dwell among their own people. They disobeyed the direct order of the king. They didn't care so much what he wanted. They did what was right. So her needs were not connected to what the government or what the military wanted. She didn't need them. They don't need her. Well, she probably paid taxes. That's a different story. Yes.
But she also didn't ask for a son. These other two women probably would have asked for a son if he had asked them the same question.
You're probably right.
But she does not. She says she wants to dwell among her own people. So she's not so concerned about having a son to take care of her needs. She wants to be among her people in her community. And she wants to fulfill their needs and have them fulfill hers. So she doesn't feel that she needs a son.
Right.
Otherwise, that would have been the first thing she asked for. Because it seems like a lot of these women, that is what they asked for.
You're right. You're
right. She did not.
You're right. A lot of them do. That is right. She identified that this is not, I am full. I have everything that I need. She may want more, but she had everything she needed. And that was what she was content with. She was content with her life. Whatever a lot she may or may not have, whatever great things she has or doesn't have, she was content with it. That's a righteous woman. It's a great woman. Personally knew God. Not that her husband did not. Quite the opposite. I'm sure he did. He even specifies, wait a minute. There's not new moon. It's not Shabbat. Why are you going to see the man of God? So clearly, on new moon and Shabbat, they would go see the man of God, at least one or both together, pretty regularly. So at least he obviously knew God also. So she knew him. He knew him. The prophet's widow is identified through a husband. The Gentile doesn't know him at all. These are different people, aren't they? They're only related, only connected to each other through their story, but not by themselves. They would be unconnected. They would never know one another for any reason. But Messiah says, I am in this story, and these stories are me and about me, and what I do or have done. He identifies that. So we get that pretty well established. That means whatever these women experienced is through the Messiah and what he is directing or intending for them to experience. So what was their experience? What is their connection that makes them all need or had to need the same thing? Because they all did. They all wound up needing the exact same thing. They needed him. They needed God. They needed Messiah. They needed some way of getting out of the problem that they are now in. But they were all completely different from each other. The same solution was given to each. That's the best thing about Messiah himself. These women are talking about people. To me, at least. The Gentile widow, which we discussed last time, the story is centered actually about her. Not her son. She was the objective of the story. She is the one who then by the end of it now knew God, went from does not know to know him. She was the objective. In the prophet's widow's story, she was not the objective. She was not going into slavery. Her future was fine. Her children were going into slavery. She wasn't the objective. The Gentile was. It was her children were. Different purpose, different goal. In the Shunammite woman's story, was she the objective? She knew God really, really well. So well, in fact, she knew that she was not to leave Elisha. Even though Gehazi had Elisha's staff and had the permission of God, she knew, or at least believed, that that was not where God is. It was not in a messenger. It was not in other words, a prophet. I use that term loosely on purpose. Gehazi was a messenger being sent, and Elisha essentially has the authority of God for all practical purposes in the story. So she knew that it wasn't the messenger that does not have the story, it is you who have it. And she threw herself at his feet, or at his legs, both times, knowing that he is the one. He is the objective. He has the story. No one else does. But was she the one saved? Saved? Well, in the Gentile story, the woman was the one that was saved. The child was brought back to life, but the woman is the one who then knew who God was. In the children with the prophet's widow story, she was not the one saved. Her children were from slavery. So the objective was her children. Her children knew God. Her children then were the objective. So we have the Gentile woman was objective first time. We have the children objective the second time. And who is the objective in the Shunammite woman? What's Messiah's objective in this part of the story? Well, this is how I personally perceive it. I will say it's sort of the child, but only sort of. It's an idea. The idea of what she demonstrates inside the story. Because unlike these other two women, she does something distinct or unique in her imploring for help. The idea of not a messenger, her son. But she bypassed the messenger. She bypassed her own husband. She knew it's not through a messenger. It's not through a man, so to speak. It was solely through God. So in this one, in the original woman for the widow story, the Gentile widow, it was that she didn't know who God was. Now she knows who God is. And the prophet's story is her children had no future in God at all. But now they have freedom. So they understand what the freedom, because they're no longer slaves. In this story, Shunammite woman, she taught us, or teaches us, it's through her actions that she teaches us. She teaches us, it's not through a man. Go directly to the source. Meaning that the source of your salvation is not through a messenger. It's from the actual being, the actual creator. Even though she goes through Elisha, that's not the part of the story. It's how she treats the messenger. It's how she treats her husband, purposefully concealing it from them, that they are not the source. So what does that tell you about Messiah? Those who do not know God will know him. Those who are slaves will not be. And he is not just a messenger. He's a real thing. Children. The children we say. He's not the messenger. The stories about these that are tied together tell us about him, tell us about who Messiah is and what his objective was. He saves these people. And he tells us about himself. He is not just a messenger. He's not just a prophet. He is here to save from slavery and save from death. That makes sense? It's a conceptual idea, but it's the idea that who this woman is, who Shunammite woman did, and how she lived her life, her actions, tells us about her. Now, I'm going to go into chapter 4 of 2 Kings later, because there's a whole lot more inside that story, that chapter, far more than I'm covering right now. But that's out of sequence, so I'm not covering it today. But there's a lot into it. Because she is not just a stagnant character, so to speak. She's dynamic. Her character changes also, but changes through her links, through her story links. Because her story links to other stories in her same Bible. They're strikingly similar. Again, it's what she does and how she acts, how she treats other individuals that makes her unique, that separates her out of them. Because she recognized something that the others did not recognize so easily. It distinguishes that. She purposely recognizes them different. She understood who God was, fully knowing him. When Messiah came, he saved all these people. Not the time which they lived, but the future on idea of who these people represent. He saved Gentiles, saved Jews, he saved Israelites, he saves the righteous, he saves the unrighteous. That we know those details. He saves these women too, with inside their stories. But I love the Shunammite woman's story because she is so eloquently done that she identifies something special about this messenger. About this prophet. He's not ordinary. He's not typical. He's strange. He's unique. Because she went out and sought him. Every time. Sought him for food, sought him for bed, sought him for healing her son. And she asked nothing in return, but she got a great blessing. She recognized something about him. These stories are tied, and God tied them together. Because he made the stories very, very similar. So we're supposed to tie them together. These women represent people. I'm going to ask you to raise your hands, but identify yourself in your own mind. To me, I identify myself with inside these women. I see myself in some of their actions and what they did. I assume most of us do as well, in one way or another, either in our life circumstances, what we have gone through or are going through, or will. But we've all been here. And Messiah addresses each one of them. Beautifully done, too. It's symbolic, of course. It's all symbolic. But the Bible usually is. Any questions or comments? This is a short session. I don't wish to speak too much longer on this part of the chapter, because chapter 18 of 1 Kings rounds off this idea of who Messiah is trying to tell us about himself, of what he turned into.